When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, you're listening to Rock and or Roll, part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. And on today's episode, I present to you an interview I conducted with guitar player, songwriter, Jeff Summers. Jeff was the brains behind an awesome early new wave of British heavy metal band called Weapon, whose song Set the Stage Alight is an absolute classic of that genre. Then Jeff joined the band with Paul Mario Day. So Paul had been in Iron Maiden and he had a band called More, and then he got a record deal and formed a new band called Wildfire. Jeff and a couple of members of Weapon ended up in Wildfire. And then the band Wildfire basically went on to become Gary Barden's band after Gary Barden left the Michael Schenker group, and that band was called State Trooper. So over the course of about less than 10 years, from the late 70s to the late 80s, Jeff was involved in these three different heavy metal hard rock bands, all of which flirted with success, but success never came, and eventually in the late 80s, he left the music business. But Jeff will describe all of that on this episode. So this is a cool story of one guitar player, songwriter, talented guy, his experiences in the music business in the early 80s into the late 80s. He made great music with several different bands, but just never broke through. But he has a great legacy, and this is a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's hear the talk I had with Jeff Summers.
You know, the difference between, you know, the biggest bands in the world and the bands that aren't the biggest bands in the world can sometimes be purely and simply luck.
Yeah.
There's something that you learn in the music business that there's so many ducks that need to be in a row for you to make it in this business. It's not like sport. If you're great at sport, then it will happen for you because, you know, if you're better than everybody else, it'll happen because people will notice. But if you're a music business, the time's got to be right for you. First of all, the time's got to be right. You've got to have the material. You've got to have the talent. You've got to have the people in the band. You've got to have the right management company, right record company, right promoters, and the right publishers. And if all of those ducks don't literally line up, then it ain't going to happen. It's as simple as that. And also, you've also got other things where, you know, musicians tend to be creative people, so they'll work on what they feel is right for them, and they'll turn down offers from other bands that go on to do really, really well on the basis of the fact that they believe in what they do, and that's what makes it great. But you know, if any of those ducks are not in a row, believe you me, it won't happen.
Yeah, and so, you know, looking at a band like Weapon, so you guys did the band form in 1980, or were you around before that?
No, the band became Weapon in 1980, but the band that was out in London and the UK playing Set the Stage Alight. And a lot of those songs from the original recordings back in 1980 was already doing that a couple of years prior to that. Weapon became Weapon when Danny Hines joined the band, because we were looking for a new singer, and we found Danny and he found us, kind of an advert and melody maker that we both responded to. And we decided that the original name of the band wasn't right. So we changed it to Weapon. So that's when it became Weapon. But it had been actually out in the marketplace for maybe 2 or 3 years prior to that, in, you know, playing the venues in some of the nice venues in London.
So did you start out as a hard rock kind of band, or so the band began before the new wave of British heavy metal was really happening?
Yeah, I mean, the band really, it kind of started with me at school, my school friends. And so I played guitar and sang, and we had a bass player and a drummer. And it kind of, you know, people fall away, the bass player decided he didn't want to do it anymore. And then we got another bass player, and then the drummer, you know, fell in love or whatever, and he didn't want to do it anymore. And then we got a new drummer, and then I decided I didn't want to sing anymore. So we got a singer in. So it eventually ended up in about 1979. Hard rock band, because, you know, Set the Stage Alight, we always opened the Set the Stage Alight from about maybe 1978.
Wow.
And we then played pretty much 80% our own material, but we also played one or two covers in amongst those. And they're a bit more obscure. There was a Gary Moore song that was off of his original solo album called Grinding Stone. And we used to play that one live. It's sort of like a good time sort of boogie, blue, hard, heavy boogie song. We also did, sometimes we did a Thin Lizzy track called Are You Ready? Pretty much, I think that was pretty much the only covers we did. The rest of it were all songs that, you know, either I wrote myself or I co-wrote with the bass player at the time. So the new way that British heavy metal was kind of happening at that time, you know, all the bands that were from London at that time were all playing on the circuit at the same time that we were. We were actually called Fast Relief at that point, believe it or not. Terrible name. But there was a lot of bands, you know, Iron Maiden, Samson, Saxon, who were called Son of the Pitch at that point. Motorhead had been around for a few years. A band called Praying Mantis. They came from the new British heavy metal era. There was lots of those guys that were playing the circuit, certainly in London at the same time that we were. So and they all had sort of, you know, modicums of success in their own way. Obviously, bands like Iron Maiden. And in particular, but, you know, maybe Saxon as well, went on and did very well. Interestingly enough, both had great, the timing was right for them. They were really good. They were really good, obviously. And they had great management, you know, and I think that's probably the difference between, say, them and maybe us and one or two other bands at the time. It could be argued that we were pulling bigger crowds than they were at the time. We just didn't get the break with the management company.
Yeah, I think, in my opinion, Set the Stage Alight is just as good as anything else. You know, one of my favorite songs that came out of that whole era, that whole genre or whatever. So, and you know, you did you guys actually record an album that wasn't released? Because you have a, there's a lot of songs that, you know, are really recorded well. It seems like you spent a lot of time in the studio, at least.
Yeah, we did. We did. At the time we recorded Set the Stage Light, we recorded pretty much a whole album. In those days, an album was about 8 or 9 songs. It was vinyl, wasn't it? And you couldn't really get any more on vinyl in those days. So we had 8 or 9 songs ready to go. And they were recorded at really good recording studios as well. They were produced independently. And we were financed at that time by Virgin. Richard Branson, who owns the company Virgin, had a recording company and a publishing company at the time. And pretty much they decided they were going to sign us. And so they put us in the studios to make, you know, master recordings, you know, which is what we did. They were all done really quickly. I mean, we were a seasoned live band at the time. And so we literally went into a Set of Stage Light. It was pretty much first or second take. You know, it was, you know, just straight in and we did it. I mean, pretty much the lead vocal was live. The only thing we did is we overdubbed the guitar solo, maybe we double tracked the guitar, and we did the backing vocals separate. But it was pretty much live. We did that at exactly the same time as a song called Liar. And they were both recorded at a studio called, let me think about it, the Townhouse, which is at Shepherd's Bush in London. And at that time, you know, the top bands were recording there. We met Phil Collins, who was recording In the Air Tonight at the very same time in that recording studio. So, you know, that was the caliber of bands that were using that studio at the time. Did well. It got out there in the world, even back in those days. I mean, you probably heard the story about Lars Ulrich and James Hetfield picking it up in an import shop in about 1981, 1982, and they absolutely loved it. They loved it. It's actually in there. There's a biography of Metallica, and it talks about the influence of the new wave British heavy metal on Metallica, and they talk about that song in particular, about how they heard it and it was so fast.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, they thought, you know, bearing in mind that it probably seems relatively tame now, but in 1980, it was kind of breakneck speed, you know,
definitely.
It was 4 young guys, totally and utterly overexcited in the studio, playing everything too fast, you know.
Yeah, there's a compilation that Lars Ulrich put together of New Wave of British Heavy Metal in maybe the early 90s, and I think Set the Stage Alight is the first song on there.
It's called A New Wave of British Heaven. Oh, 79 Revisited, I think it's called.
Right.
Something like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean, you know, I met Lars and James about 1983. I was playing in the band Wildfire at that point, because Heaven had kind of imploded on the back of the fact that we couldn't get a decent management deal and the other bands were taking off. I'd been asked to join the band Wildfire, and we were playing at a venue in London, and Lars and James and Cliff Burton turned up. They'd heard our band Wildfire on a rock show, a Friday rock show in the UK. It was actually called the Friday Rock Show on BBC Radio 1. It was hosted by a guy called Tommy Vance. Do you know Tommy Vance? Mm-hmm. Have you heard of him? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we did a live session on the Friday rock show. It was a big show at the time. I mean, you know, everybody that was into rock in the UK would listen to it on a Friday night before they went down the pub or before they went to see a band or whatever. And they were listening to it, and they'd heard it, and they heard that we were playing, and Tommy said that we were playing in London that night, so they came down. And we didn't really know who they were, because they, you know, we this Metallica to us, there was somebody had written a book, I think it was a guy called Jeff Barton, called the Encyclopedia Metallica, Metallica.
Right.
It basically was, you know, it had every band from about 1968, 69 that was involved in hard rock and had something about them in it. And it had Weapon in it. So we knew about the book, and the band came up to us and said, "We're called Metallica." And we said, "Oh, what you mean like?" I mean, honestly, they were that unknown at the time. We said, "What you mean like the Encyclopedia Metallica?" And they said, "Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's kind of where we got the name from. I don't know if they ever told me about that, but that's what they told us." And then they questioned us. They said, "What other bands have you been in?" And the drummer, who was the same drummer that was in Weapon, a guy called Bruce Bisland, and was now in Wildfire, said, "Well, Jeff and I were in a band called Weapon," and they literally fell over. They literally fell on their knees and did the "We Are Not Worthy" thing right in front of us. And they said, "If it wasn't to set the stage alight, there would be no Metallica."
Yeah, I mean, it really is a killer song. And especially, you said you had it back to 78, I think you said?
Yeah, I was about 18 or 19 when we wrote that, yeah.
So what do you think inspired... I mean, you said you played it really fast in the studio. Was it maybe not quite as fast when you first wrote it and started playing it, or?
Well, it was fast, but it wasn't as fast as that.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same song, though. It was, you know, the song was exactly the same, the riff and the chorus and, you know, the lyrics and everything were the same. Really, a lot of it was the drummer. Again, his name is Bruce Bisland. He was a double bass drummer. Yeah. And the first guy that played the original demo of the song. I've got it somewhere, I don't know where it is, still got that we'd recorded that 1978, 79. He couldn't play double bass drums. So he kind of emulated it on the snare. So it was fast, it had to be fast. He couldn't play on single bass drum. But Bruce, the original drummer, was could play double bass drums really, really comprehensively, really fast. So the minute he joined the band, you know, the song became, you know, what it is now. Those double bass drums were, you know, just phenomenal for, you know, a 17 or 18 year old kid that he was at the time. You know, it was just something else.
Do you remember writing the song? Like, do you remember what inspired it, or what the inception of it was like?
Yeah, I was really into Deep Purple, and I was trying to rewrite Burn, the song Burn.
Right.
I remember thinking that, you know, it was such a great riff, the way it was bouncing off the, well, not an open, not, I discovered quite quickly, I thought he was bouncing off of an open A string. But Blackmore's cleverer than that. He was basically forming the bass note in G with his thumb while he was playing that fantastic riff. So I'm kind of trying to play around with that and get something like, something that felt like that. So that's what I came up with. So I was playing the, but I knew how the Burn riff went because I knew how to play it, and I didn't want to emulate it, but I wanted that kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the tempo that was originally written in, which is quite fast, but not as fast as the stage of life became. And so, you know, when it came to writing the lyric, I had the melody and everything. And when it came to writing the lyric, I just thought about, you know, the analogy and the feeling, that rush you get when you go on stage, you know. And when you're that young and you're playing to audiences and they're all sort of like literally running towards the stage once you come on, you know, people in those days, because it was relatively new, you know, the audience that had never seen you before, they'd either think, "Oh, this is it, this is what we want," and they'd run towards you, or they'd run out because it was too loud and too noisy for them. So it was kind of, that was the analogy of the song, really. You know, the fact that if it's too loud for you, then, you know, on your bike. But if you do like us, you know, run towards us and run us, you know, as the song says, run like Satan in a rage. I mean, I don't know where that line came from, but, you know, it's in the song.
Yeah.
Down, the beaches, you just got high.
So what was it like to be in the middle of the new wave of British heavy metal? It seems like all of a sudden, within a year or two, there were just like hundreds of bands, and it was just became like this, you know, for a short period, it was like this really big movement. Yeah. Did it kind of take you by surprise when it just kind of exploded like that?
Well, it's difficult to, you know, I'd grown up on bands like Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, Queen, Thin Lizzy, Led Zeppelin, UFO, all the early sort of, you know, innovators of, you know, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, without those bands, there would never have been a new wave of British heavy metal. And then, of course, you know, by the time it got to the point where I decided I wanted to play guitar and wanted to get into a band, it began to taper off. And then in the UK in particular, punk became enormous about 1975, 1976. So you had bands that had, you know, a completely different attitude in their music, and they weren't great players, but it was all about the attitude and all about anti-establishment and everything else. So being just a teenager myself, I got it. I understood it, but it wasn't for me because it wasn't musical enough. However, you know, I had friends that were punks that became punks, that were the metal guys that became punks. You know, ordinary guys that went down the pub and walked around in, you know, everyday clothes, suddenly, you know, they had spiky haircuts and they dyed their eyebrows green. God knows why, you know. So I knew something was really, really big was happening with punk. I've always said when anybody asked me this, that without punk, you wouldn't have had the new wave of British heavy metal, because it was an antithesis to punk, because us guys that were playing metal at that, you know, prior to that and during that period of time, and we were actually younger than the punks, but we knew we could play better than they could, and we knew there was more to it than they were doing. So what we did is basically, when punk, we just carried on through it playing our hard rock. We didn't really see anything. I mean, we didn't see anything happening other than more and more people suddenly began to come to the shows. Because I'm from London, that area of London, suddenly, you know, all of the bands from that era would kind of like hang around together, we'd go and see the same bands together. And so we realized something was happening, like metal was on its way back, because it had gone into the doldrums for about 2 years during the punk era. Mm-hmm. And there was no chance for a young band to come through during that period, probably 76 to 77, 75 to 77, I'd say, maybe 78. But then all of a sudden, around about 1979, they began to sign the rock and metal bands again. So, you know, people like, you know, Iron Maiden and Saxon and Def Leppard and us and Praying Mantis and one or two other bands began to get signed. So we knew obviously something was happening, but we didn't know what it was. It's a great time. Everybody was suddenly walking around with motorbike jackets and tight jeans and long hair. And we're talking about Eddie Van Halen and Richie Blackmore. Those two were the guitar players that everybody was talking about in England at that time. You know, and then of course we started to see things coming over from Van Halen had a big look about it, I think, because when the first Van Halen album came out in 78, everybody that I knew that at that time that was in the hard rock, and we used to go to all the gigs, all the places where, you know, the hard rock discos and nightclubs and that kind of stuff, all the people I knew absolutely loved the first Van Halen album. It was hugely influential, you know, and that was full of, you know, that was full of attitude as well, wasn't it? You know, it wasn't just hard rock. It was something very different they were doing at that time. For me, it might not seem that way to you. It's probably a lot younger than I am. But for me and most of my, I mean, a lot of the guys I spoke to, I used to hang around at the time, gave up playing guitar when they heard that album, because yeah. Eddie was just like from another planet. Nobody knew what the hell he was doing. And people at the time were saying, that isn't the guitar. There isn't a guitar that's going on there. It's a studio effect and it's keyboard, it's violin, it's this, it's that and the other. So nobody knew what he was doing. It's only when Van Halen came over to it and toured, I think in 79 with Black Sabbath, that we saw what he was doing and we began to figure it out. But yeah, I reckon that Van Halen sort of heralded the end of the dominance of the punk era. Gave all us, lot, including bands like Iron Maiden, the opportunity to come forward.
It's interesting to hear that Van Halen was influential on you guys, because I don't know if I've ever really heard that, heard them connected to the new wave of British heavy metal too much before. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but at the same time, I think it's just because nothing else sounds like Van Halen just because of Eddie. So,
yeah,
I mean, it's like, I can see that you guys were inspired, but it was hard to be influenced by him, right? Because you couldn't really, no one could really copy him, or, you know,
we couldn't do it. That's right. We didn't know what he was doing. You know, we did.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we were our guitar heroes at that time were Gary Moore, Richie Blackmore, Brian May from Queen, Michael Schenker, you know, maybe Jeff Beck and Jimi Hendrix. I mean, you know, I mean, there were some great guitarists around. I mean, absolutely brilliant, and all very unique in their own way. But then Eddie, you know, he just basically busted the whole thing wide open, and you know, to the point where some people actually refused to acknowledge it. You know, it was kind of like, I'll just ignore him and he'll go away, sort of thing. You know, it's just too good. You know, whereas those of us who love the guitar were just immediately fans and decided, well, I don't think we can do what he's doing, but we can maybe pick up on some of his attitude and his songwriting. He was such a great songwriter, you know. I mean, it's so many strings to his bow. I mean, you've got to bear in mind that Eddie was only 21 himself in those days when the album was released. So, and they were a very young band. They were sort of our ages, so maybe a little bit older than us, but not much. Whereas the previous bands, you know, the members of, you know, I don't know, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, Thin Lizzy, Queen, they were all, you know, 10, 15, 16 years older than us, whereas Eddie was only maybe a year or two older than us. So that's what made it even harder for us, because we thought, bloody hell, we've got to be that good at 21. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you take the best you can from Eddie and what you learned, and then try to, you know, incorporate that into what you do.
Right. So did you actually have a record deal with Virgin? Did Weapon?
We had a publishing deal, which was, you know, which was the foot in the door for the record deal. And we were pretty much told that they were going to sign us. We had an advance on our publishing, on our songwriting. And with that advance, we were invited by Fast Eddie Clarke to go on tour with Motorhead.
Okay.
On the Ace of Spades tour. And we thought, basically, we went on that tour. And this would probably been sort of October, about this time of year, really, you know, 42 years ago. We went on the tour, it ended up costing us a fortune, but we weren't, you know, because it was paid for via our advance. But we were under the impression that when, you know, the single was going to be released on Virgin and we were going to be supported by them, and then the album would come out shortly after the end of the tour or whatever. But Virgin decided not to sign us. And the reason they decided not to sign us was because they signed the band Gillan. It's Ian Gillan's band.
Yeah.
Now, Ian Gillan left Deep Purple about 5 years before and had pretty much retired from the industry, you know, probably the number one hard rock singer in the world and the number one hard rock band in the world. And he retired. He was only young when he retired. And he utilized his money to go into business. And my understanding is the business has failed, and he came back and started getting his music again. So they signed him instead of us. And obviously we understood that because, you know, we'd all been so influenced by Purple that he's such an incredible singer that we were all pleased to have him back, you know, because when you're a kid, that's how you are, you know, your heroes, your heroes, and that's it. You know, we didn't for one minute think, well, thanks Ian, you know, you buggered up our opportunities. We just thought, well, we'll get another deal. But of course it never quite worked out that way.
Right. So would It's a Mad, Mad World, was that the single that Virgin was looking at releasing that you mentioned?
Making a friend.
they loved it. They couldn't decide whether to release Set the Stage Alight or It's a Mad Mad World, but they decided that Mad Mad World was more radio friendly. Mm-hmm. Across the board, it was more, you know, the sort of thing that daytime radio would play, as not just the rock shows. So what they did is they put it out as a double A side with Mad Mad World as a dominant track, and with Set the Stage Alight on the B side. But they put it out as a 12-inch and a 7-inch single. So it did well. I mean, at the time, I mean, in the UK, there was they used to have a separate rock chart in the UK. They had a general sort of pop chart, the rock chart in the UK, and it was put together by Radio Play and Sounds Music Magazine at the time, and Kerrang and all those kind of magazines that were around at the time. And from all that airplay and the familiarity of the magazines and everything, it got to number two in the UK heavy metal charts, if you like. And they also released it on import as well as just in the UK. So it went out to America, which is where Lars and James heard it, and Japan, and, you know, it went out all over the world. And it was, you know, it's still got a life of its own, that song. It's, you know, I still get people asking me questions about it all the time.
So Virgin put that out. Okay. Yeah. I have the 12-inch. I have the 12-inch version. And that's such a great record. I mean, those two songs are great. You know, it's like I've said, it's just as good, in my opinion, or better than anything else. And obviously, you know, it hit a nerve with Lars and James and guys like that, because it's a hell of a record.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We went out with the band kind of, you know, disintegrated towards the end of 81. We got frustrated. We weren't getting signed. We were young and we were arguing with each other, and we couldn't get the right management company. And, you know, we made some bad decisions. I mean, kids do, you know. What you needed was a management company to come in and say, look, guys, you know, do as you're told. This is what we're going to do, which is exactly what happened to Iron Maiden. Rod Smallwood said to Steve Harris, you basically do what I tell you. Don't do what you want to do. You do what I tell you. Follow me and I'll make you stars. And we had people that came in and just let us run ourselves. And we were just, you know, we were drinking too much. We were, you know, doing all the stuff that you do when you're young, you know, and not really concentrating on what we should have been doing, you know. Whereas bands like Maiden, I think they were a bit more switched on in terms of business than we were. Certainly Steve Harris was, anyway. Festival, the Headbangers Ball in 2005, which was, I mean, 2005 would have been 24 years after we split up. And they approached Danny, our singer, about it and said, would you come out and play it? And we said, well, the band doesn't exist anymore. And they said, well, can you get the original band back together? So we did. So we spoke to the drummer, Bruce, and we spoke to the bass player, Baz. And so we went out and played it again. And we enjoyed it so much, we thought we'll make another album. So we made two more albums after that. While we were playing these festivals, because we hadn't played for 24 years, all the bands were on there were a little bit in awe of Weapon, because they'd all heard Set the Stage Alight, Mad Bad World and everything else. And they all kind of, you know, we didn't know that. We didn't know that. We really didn't. And then, you know, guys, one of the bands, it's a Belgian band, I can't remember what they're called now. But he said that when he heard Set the Stage Alight, he used to basically, you know, headbang around the room with a tennis racket and play this over and over again to the point where his parents smashed the record up. You know, it's, and you know, I guess that's just, although I didn't do the tennis racket thing, I guess that's a lot of what I did when I used to, you know, listen to, you know, Deep Purple and Queen and Thin Lizzy. So, you know, it's to hear that aspect of it, that we've been a positive influence on people's lives. You know, that's a bit special, really, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and so there's some other songs that Weapon recorded in 1981, like Remote Control and Light of the World. Those are great songs. But I guess you just kind of, like you said, it kind of fell apart because it just, you know, it was only a year or two, but it must seem like a long time at the time that you couldn't make it happen, and you're watching other bands, you know, their careers take off. And so the band just kind of.
Well, I mean, I remember having a kind of, it kind of imploded. I mean, you know, just to round that off, I remember at the time having a conversation with the guitar player John Sykes. Do you remember John Sykes? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was in Thin Lizzy at the time, or no,
he was in
Tigers of Pantang.
Yeah, we were at the Marquee Club in London, which is where pretty much everybody used to hang out. And we'd all begun to realize it was becoming more and more difficult to get a record deal, and music was changing. And you know, the new in the UK, what they called the new romantic era with Duran Duran and, you know, Spandau Ballet and Nick Kershaw and his kind of bands were all coming forward. And I remember chatting to the bar with John, and we were playing that night and the support band was on, and John said, I think we've missed the boat, mate. You know, it was kind of that sort of conversation, you know. And I said, well, you know, don't be thinking about it, John. You know, it's you know, things could still happen. And of course it did for him, because within about 3 months he was in Thin Lizzy.
Right. And then, of course, Whitesnake. Well, he ended up getting screwed on that deal. But so then, how did Wildfire come together then?
Well, Wildfire was it was the baby of Paul Mary O'Day.
Yeah.
And Paul was the original. I'm pretty sure was the original singer in Iron Maiden. There's Paul Mary O'Day, and there's another guy, Dennis somebody. I can't remember his name now. After Paul. Paul left or got kicked out of Iron Maiden because Paul was quite young, and although he was a great singer, he didn't really have the stagecraft that they were looking for. So I think he got kicked out, and then they got Paul Di'Anno in, and Paul Di'Anno, who is probably not as good a singer as Paul Murray O'Day, but he had much better stagecraft. So Paul Murray O'Day ended up playing in a band called Moore, who were from the new wave of British heavy metal era as well. And he was offered a European record deal after he left Moore if he put a band together. So he did. He basically put, he got various musicians together, including a guy called Laurie Mansworth, who played guitar with him in the band Moore. Bruce Bisland, the drummer that had been in Weapon. Mm-hmm. A guy called Martin Bushell, who played guitar in Wildfire. And bass player Jeff Brown. And it didn't work out with Laurie Mansworth as the other guitar player. So Bruce suggested me. At that time, I was kind of on the verge of joining two or three other bands, but I was really keen to play with Bruce again because he's such a great drummer and a great friend. So so they asked me to come along and have a blast, which I did. And then when we finished, they offered me the job. So that's pretty much how Wildfire came together.
So Paul basically had the deal before he had the band.
That's right, he did. Yeah. But it wasn't a big deal. It was Mausoleum Records. Mausoleum was an independent European company. But they really, really, really believed in what they loved Wildfire. They really believed in Wildfire. You know, they put a lot of money into us, to be fair. But again, we had management. We had good management. But I think it was just a bit too late for us. You know, again, it's where the timing thing comes in. I think it was just a bit too late for us. I think that we were a bit like Weapon. We were quite unique for our time, you know. Sort of 82, 83, was these little bands like, you know, Bon Jovi. It was before hair metal, that sound, you know. And we'd kind of hung our hat on writing really melodic, radio-friendly songs, but played really heavy. So, you know, you'd had bands like Journey, you had bands like The Foreigner, and you had bands like Boston, who were all great rock bands and all had wrote great songs, but they weren't particularly powerful. So we wanted to take that aspect of songwriting, very commercial, instantly catchy songs, but make them really powerful and heavy. So that's kind of where Wildfire came from, It would have worked. Unfortunately, they weren't produced terribly well. The songs weren't produced as well as they could have been. But I reckon that first Wildfire album, Brute Force and Ignorance, it's kind of, I think, one of the first of its kind. So two or three tracks on there are, looking back at it in retrospect, two or three tracks on it are, you know, definitely the foundation of, I think, what happened a bit later on with hair metal. It was before what hair metal that was, 1982 was before that.
Yeah, it's definitely very catchy songs, very melodic, but really great guitars at the same time.
Yeah, and powerful drums and you know, lots of harmonies, lots of vocal harmonies. Yeah. You know, going back to the Queen thing, you know, when I was a kid, I mean, you know, I'm a singer too, and so I loved harmony, you know, and it's interesting because I was playing in Bulgaria about 10 years ago with Dennis Stratton, who used to be in Iron Maiden. Mm-hmm. And he was actually fired from Iron Maiden for listening to Queen. Steve Harris and Rod Smallwood had basically given the whole band instruction to only listen to heavy metal and nothing else. It looks to me as if in the end of the day, it was probably good advice because, you know, Maiden went on and obviously became huge. But Dennis wasn't really into that. Dennis really loved the Eagles, for instance. You know, he loved vocal bands. He loved Queen, he loved Thin Lizzy, he loved the blues. So coming from his bedroom would be, you know, the likes of Queen, and Rod would go past his hotel room and tell him to turn it off and start listening to, you know, Black Sabbath or Deep Purple. So, and he refused to do it. So he lost his job. He told me that.
Yeah. Seems like the second Wildfire album, Summer Lightning, was maybe even more of an attempt at like a more commercial sound. Was it like a conscious effort, or?
Well, it was kind of, you know, I had more to do with the songwriting on that one. On the first album, some of the songs had been written, so I just added things to them, like choruses and guitar harmonies. There's a track on the first album called Victim of Love, which is, at the time, would have probably been a successful single if it was released, you know, by a big label maybe, and had been produced slightly better.
Yeah, that does seem like the obvious single from the record, yeah.
I mean, you know, the record company always say, give us a single, you know, so they all look at me, you know. And so, you know, I'm one of those kind of eclectic writers. I like to write in many styles, but I like to write something that catches your eye, your ear very quickly. And not necessarily your metal ear, but maybe, you know, your melodic ear. But at the same time, you know, I also write songs like, you know, Set the Stage Alight and Ride the Mariah and the Key and, you know, and some of the stuff from State Trooper and that later on, which is really, really heavy, because I love heavy music too, you know, I mean, I love it all. But I've always been trying to strive to find something that is unique and can connect instantly with people. And I think if you strive for that, you end up writing something melodic. Otherwise you alienate people, you know, too much, maybe. I don't know, it's just been my philosophy, I guess. Maybe it's wrong, maybe it's right, I don't know. But that's my philosophy. But yeah, with the second album, people like, you know, people have been having hit singles as, you know, hard rock bands have started having hit singles again. You know, Whitesnake, Rainbow, Van Halen, Def Leppard, Iron Maiden, with Run to the Hills and things like that. They've begun to have hit singles. So by the time we got to Summer Lightning, which was 1983, you know, we realized, well, hang on a minute, we need to be a bit more accessible musically. we didn't necessarily consciously do it. We just did what we all agreed. We all said, yeah, this is what we want to do. So we did it. And then, you know, so one of the boys would write a song and bring it in, and everybody'd say, well, where's the chorus? You know, and then look at me, and I'd say, well, how about this? And that's kind of, so it became much more of a, you know, a collective songwriting team by that point, as opposed to, you know, Paul and Martin writing on one side and me writing on the other. We began to write together on Summer Lightning, and that was the consequence of the music at that point.
But with the record label that you were working with, it probably just was hard to, you know, sell records and you know, get noticed, get the material out there onto the radio. And you didn't really make any videos, did you?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. What did we make? We made Jerusalem. We I don't know if you heard, we did a version of the British hymn Jerusalem. I don't know if you heard that, but we made a video for that.
Okay.
And we were on TV in the UK and France and Italy and places like that.
Oh, okay.
So there's live performance, and we played live. We didn't mind. We played live.
Walk upon England's mountains green, and watch the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen. And did the countenance divine shine forth upon Jerusalem, built it here on these dark Satanic hills. My blood, I'm burning gold. Bring me my arrows out here.
So it was mainly the Summer Lightning album. That's where the record company felt that they, because they had a few bands at the time, and they felt that they'd got something there with Summer Lightning. They thought, we've got something a bit special here. We think this could be real commercial success. But unfortunately, they didn't really have the money to push it, to get us out on a big tour. I mean, that's the thing. It's money, those right connections. You know, I know it seems crazy and it's awful to think that, you know, the big bands that are out there could have floundered like everybody else if the money hadn't been there to put them in front of people.
Right. Yeah. Did Wildfire do much touring?
Well, we toured with the band Hawkwind in the UK. They weren't right. They weren't right for us. They were a kind of a space rock band, yeah. And they were all getting on a bit. They were all pretty approaching 40 at that time. So we were all kids. And we were all dressing for the day, you know, and, you know, we all started to backcomb our hair and start to, you know, get into the hair metal thing. But the audience absolutely loved us because the audience is quite young. The audience really, really likes us. We were actually fired from that tour because, you know, we were going down a bit too well, I think. And
right.
One or two other reasons, but they decided to deal with us on the tour. Their excuse was that we weren't right for their audience, but their audience absolutely loved us. So, but anyway, you know, that's a long time ago. So we did that tour, and we did some festivals in Europe. We played in Belgium and Holland and Germany. We played in the UK, quite a lot in the UK, sort of doing our own tours and that kind of stuff. But that was all. That was all, really.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
And then State Trooper is basically Wildfire, but you replace Paul with Gary Barden, it seems like.
It seems like that, but what it was is Gary Barden had left the Michael Schenker group. Mm-hmm. We knew Gary because he used to kind of hang around the same sort of places that we did. Lovely, lovely man. Really, really great guy. And a big star at the time. I mean, you know, he was a big star. I mean, he's, you know, very, very unique voice and charisma on stage and all that kind of stuff. Gary basically ended up getting signed by the same management company that we had called London's Pride. Mm-hmm. We were signed to London's Pride, and we were looked after by a guy called Dave Chapman, who we're all still friends with. I mean, Dave was great. And we were on that tour with Hawkwind, and Gary was putting State Trooper together, and he put the band together with two brothers. They were the Johnson brothers. Steve Johnson and Fasker Johnson, the bass player, who went on to play with Saxon later on, and they were great, really, really good. But they really liked Wildfire, and they used to come see us play. But they lost their drummer, and they asked if Bruce could step in. And so Bruce stepped in for their demos, and he was so good that they couldn't replace him. So they asked him to join State Trooper. And, you know, Gary was a big star. And so Bruce came to me and said, look, I've been asked to do this. And I said, well, look, you can't turn it down, Bruce. You know, it's an opportunity, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to do it. You know, I mean, I want you in my band, but, you know, I'm sure you'd say the same to me. And then literally the last gig that the band did was a live gig on a TV program in the UK called ECT, which meant extraterrestrial transmission. So you had sort of four live bands playing in front of a live audience every Friday night. And the top of the bill band would be a big band. It'd be an AC/DC, you know, Thin Lizzy, you know, whatever at that time in the UK. And we went on before, who was it? Oh, it was Gary Moore and Phil Lynott. They were doing the song Out in the Fields. Do you know that song?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It was a big hit in the UK. And I think they were in the charts with it in the UK at the time. And we did two live songs before that. So that was our last sort of gig, if you like. And the next day, got a telephone call. And Gary said that he didn't want to continue working with the Johnson Brothers. You know, and he'd like he'd like to use the musicians in Wildfire for his new band. So we had to make a decision there and then. And unfortunately, tell Paul that we were all leaving.
Right.
Which was not great. I got the job, as I always did, of telling Paul the situation. I think to this day he made me.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't down to me. I mean, I was probably the only one that was in two minds about it, because I believed in Paul. I love Paul's voice, and we were writing together really, really well. Don't get me wrong, I loved Gary too, but I thought the Wildfire were onto something, and it's just the feeling you get, you know. But in the end, the bottom line is I realised quite quickly, if I stayed, it'd be me and Paul and nobody else. We'd have to replace the rest of the band.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how State Trooper came about. So, you know, the management company and Gary wanted Wildfire as musicians to be part of State Trooper.
And then State Trooper ends up being much poppier, more of like an AOR band. I do a series of episodes on my podcast where I play AOR songs, and I've played She Got the Look on there. That's a really great AOR song. I love that song.
Thank you, Brian.
And so, you know, how did that the sound of State Trooper, was it just because that kind of had more potential in terms of being successful, that kind of a style or this kind of sound that State Trooper landed on? Or is that just what Gary, the direction that Gary wanted to take it? Or
no, again, it was just a natural thing. I mean, you had the same writers and musicians from Wildfire, and just Gary's voice on top. But Gary's actually a very commercial writer. He doesn't write commercially deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
He just seems to have a knack of pulling a great line that you remember. With State Trooper, we already had three songs written for the next, which would have been the third Wildfire album. One was Veni Vidi Vici. The other was Set Fire to the Night. And the third one was She Got the Look. So we'd actually written those for Wildfire, but Paul hadn't sung them. Paul had a back injury at the time. And we were in rehearsal, and Paul hadn't sung them. So myself and the bass player were singing them. So you'd had Veni Vidi Vici, which was written originally by myself and Martin Bushell. We'd written the guitar parts and the melodies, but we hadn't completed the lyrics because we were kind of flailing around trying to find something to write about that was different and unique. Yeah. And Set Fire to the Night was the same thing. It was written by myself and Martin Bushell. And then we had She Got the Look, which I wrote. And so we brought them into Gary, and Gary said, if you don't mind, I'll have a tweak around with these. So we did. So we came up with Vinnie Vinnie Vici, which basically means is Latin for I came, I saw, I conquered. And he wrote the song about the whole idea of, you know, the Christians and the lions, and the gladiators. I mean, that song's basically about gladiators. And Set Fire to the Night, you know, he played around with that, came up with some great lines for that as well. He's got an incredible sense of timing in his voice, Gary. He's got a very unique sense of timing for this. She Got the Look. It basically said, well, I can't really do anything with that, Jeff. You know, I'm happy with it as it is. So he left it as it was and just sang it pretty much the way I sang the demo. And that's that. So those three songs were really Wildfire songs. But again, you know, the record company said, by that time, we were talking about, I think that album was about 1985 when we started to write that album. So the record company said, okay, this is really, this is commercial stuff. And by that time, Bon Jovi were happening big, you know, and then Motley Crue and bands like that. And we weren't competing with them, but we found ourselves in that arena. You know, we just found it was almost like a natural progression. As you're young and you're writing, you know, you're always trying to find that elusive melody. As a songwriter, that's what, you know, you're always trying to find something that, you know, that everybody will remember and, you know, and will stay with people for a long time. And well, certainly that was my angle on it all anyway. And I think your music just naturally becomes more mature, more commercial. It goes away. It goes away slightly from the cult side of things. You know, it becomes more accessible to larger groups of people. You know, we found, for instance, with Wildfire, we found and State Trooper, we found more girls coming to our gigs. Mm-hmm. You know, than we did boys. And Weapon had a nice mix, but with Wildfire and State Trooper, we found that, you know, we were, instead of just having all the headbanging boys, and plenty of those, which is great, we also had lots of lovely-looking ladies. You know, we weren't going to complain about that.
But it seems like State Trooper ended up not lasting very long, huh?
Well, it was 85. Well, again, it was, you know, we couldn't get that elusive big deal. Gary had signed to a big publishing deal at the time, Warner Brothers. Everybody that wanted to sign the bands at that time knew the money was in the songs.
Yeah.
And they wanted the band, they wanted all of the band. They wanted the songs, they wanted the rights to the merchandise, they wanted the, you know, the recording rights, they wanted all that stuff. But Gary's stuff was already signed up to Warner Brothers because he was working with Michael Schenker. So, you know, we had a really, really great meeting with Geffen at the time. Geffen signed Aerosmith. They didn't sign us. We were really, really unlucky. Our management company had offices in a place called Liverpool Street in North London, and by a very, very well-known London train station called Liverpool Street Station. And we had not David Geffen himself, but his right-hand man came over to meet us, came out, took us all out for a meal, and, you know, and took us down the pub and everything. And he absolutely wanted to sign State Trooper. And we thought it was in the bag, and then we got a phone call from the management company. And the management company said, well, they're not going to sign you. We said, well, why not? And they said, well, your publishing, Gary's publishing was with Warner Brothers, and mine was with Virgin Music Publishing. So they realized that me and Gary were, an important writers in the band, and they knew they weren't going to get our publishing. So they decided at that time, I believe, Aerosmith were out of their publishing and got signed. But Aerosmith obviously were much bigger in the States, and Geffen were a big band from that perspective. But I think they had issues with Aerosmith at the time, because Aerosmith, they felt, were yesterday's band. They felt they were a band that had gone as far as they could. Whereas with us, they thought we were an up-and-coming band, and we could have become massive. But they weren't prepared to do it without the publishing.
Yeah, the damn business. the way the business has worked over the years, there's so many stories like that where there's just these stupid technicalities that keep the doors closed.
Exactly.
For someone like you, it's just crazy to look back on it. And it's like, it basically, in this 5-year period, you have like, you're a part of this whole heavy metal explosion with Weapon, and you know, you've got this almost deal with Virgin, and then you've got this opportunity with Paul Mario Day, and then that turns into an opportunity with Gary Barton, and it must have just seemed like a blur. And then you come out of it at the end and you're like, well, what do I do now? Probably, right?
Yeah. Well, that's right. Exactly. That's exactly how it was. And you know, by that time I'd, I'd met my future wife and we had a daughter in a situation where I could no longer, work as a musician, because I just wasn't earning enough money. You know, in those days, bands cost money. You didn't actually make money from them. As the management companies and the record companies or publishing companies put money into bands, you end up owing money, you know, unless you broke big. But they were taking chances with young musicians, you know. So I decided probably about 1988, I think. State Trooper just finished a tour. We've been out to Spain, which is where I live now. And we've been out on tour with Blue Oyster Cult and did some festivals and things. And you know, I just thought, it's not going to happen for me. It's not going to happen for me. You know, I've got to make a choice here. What do I do? You know, to be honest with you, I was missing my family when I was away. I was missing my daughter. You know, it was just a baby, and I was coming back, and she'd grown, and you know, I'm thinking, oh God, I'm missing all that. You know, so I decided, time to get out, get your hair cut, and get yourself a proper job again. You know.
Yeah.
Those 5 years, people never. It's a real joy that people remember those songs and those bands so fondly. You know, people really, really, really love those bands.
Yeah, it must feel great to at least have accomplished. I mean, that's the most important thing, is that you did good work that has had a lasting effect. And you know, as an artist, you definitely succeeded. I mean, you know, success, you can judge it on in a lot of different ways, but the lasting effect of a song like Set the Stage Alight is definitely something to be very proud of.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brian. I didn't realize it at the time. And, you know, when I came out of the music business, I thought it'd all been forgotten and everything. It was only later on, when I started playing in Europe and places, that I realized it wasn't. And, you know, when I got the phone call from Jeff Barton, who put the 79 Revisited album together, and he said he was doing it with Lars Ulrich and some other people, and they basically said they wouldn't do the compilation without the song. You know, I just said, yeah, take it. You know, it's an honor for me for it to be recognized in that way, you know.
It's too bad Metallica never covered it.
Well, the track, Hit the Lights, it's very similar, isn't it?
Yeah. So even though you left the music business, at some point, I guess you got back into it, at least on some level, huh?
Yeah, well, I never stopped playing. I continued playing bands and doing the occasional, session and playing some solos and writing some stuff for people and that sort of stuff, and playing around London and what have you. And then, as I say, rewind on to about 2005, and in actual fact, before that, 2002, there was an online petition from Japan to issue the first State Trooper album on CD, because it was only released on vinyl and cassette at the time. And I was unaware of this, and I hadn't spoken to the members of the band other than Bruce, the drummer, who's still a great friend of mine. And Gary Barden rang me and said, there's a petition to release our album on CD. So we said, okay, well, why don't we do it ourselves? It'd be easy enough. We still got the master tapes and blah, blah, blah. So we did. I think we printed up about 5,000 copies, thinking that, we'd sell 5,000. We sold 25,000 the first 2 weeks. And it entered the Japanese import charts. And then we began to get calls from Japan, from their various distributors, to put it into their shops and various bits and pieces, which we did. And then we, incredibly got offered a record deal by EMI in Japan to make another album.
Right.
So, we made the album The Calling, 20, God, how many years after that, after the original release, 20 odd years after the original release. So that kind of brought me back into the business, properly on the recording side. Yeah, I mean, it was a really pleasant surprise to be talking to people all over the world again about, about that music, about the songs Veni Vidi Vinci, She Got the Look, and Set Fire to the Night, and Shaker Things to Come, which is the opening track on there. I mean, people absolutely loved it, and they said that they'd grown up with it, And we were asked to play festivals and gigs, which we did. We did a few. And then people would turn up from Japan to see us playing in Sheffield, at the northern part of England and what have you, and in London, and from Japan and Germany and America. People were coming from all over the place to see us, and they seemed to know more about us than we did. It was a great time. We really, really enjoyed it. But Gary got offered the opportunity to go back and sing with Michael Schenker again. Mm-hmm. So, he had to take that. And Bruce, the drummer, is playing in the glam rock group The Sweet. We were still touring all over Europe and earning very good money doing it. So he didn't want to take the chance. And from my perspective, I was working full time then and, didn't really want to take the chance financially either. I had a mortgage and everything. I didn't want to take the chance financially either. So that was it. So that was me coming back in, sort of like to the music business and playing again.
You put my motor in drive, yeah, when we synchronize. You talk dirty, you're talking good, you're thinking dirty when you look at me. Oh yeah. Yeah, when you move your hand, girl, you make me stand. God's on our side, we're gonna ride. You don't care if the people stare, you see things to be so lucky and we're debonair. No, I ain't
Thank you so much for talking to me, Jeff. It was great.
Appreciate the chat.
DJ. be back.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.